This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every single week, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, last week we had a really fun show, at least I thought it was fun, where we talked about Quark's mom, Moogie. And now it's hard to believe that we are already back around to the fourth episode in our look at the final chapter. We're already here, four episodes in.
Chris, it is crazy. I was thinking of that today. I couldn't believe that we were here. And then the other part of it hit me was that we've really got so much more left. I mean, there's so much story going on. Five more episodes after this. I mean, if you count the fact that the end is two parts, I mean, it's 2 hours. So it's kind of like two episodes, even though it really is one cohesive story there at the end. I love this ending. You know, I don't know if I've ever seen a TV show kind of top what I saw here in Deep Space Nine. It is exciting every time we get to roll around this because I just love the excuse, Chris, to have to watch the end of Deep Space Nine again. Oh, darn. I got to watch the end of Deep Space Nine again.
Yesterday, while I was working, I had the episode we're going to talk about today, The Changing Face of Evil, playing. And I watched it again, you know, after that to really dig into it. But I had it playing while I was working. And then I kept going to the next episode and the next episode. And I was thinking, Matthew and I, we need to just go off on a retreat somewhere and just record all the parts of The Orb. Look at the final chapter all at one time. I just cannot stop watching this.
That would be a lot of fun. I can't imagine how long that would take, because I think we just keep talking, you know, especially right. If we're on retreat, we don't have to have any hour markers, you know. Oh, it's hour 562.
Exactly. Well, let's go ahead and jump in because we've got a lot to talk about today. Now, today, as I mentioned, we're going to be talking about The Changing Face of Evil, which is the fourth part of the final chapter. We've already covered Penumbra, Till Death Do Us Part, and Strange Bedfellows. And the interesting thing about The Changing Face of Evil is that it is the final part of the first block of the arc. They actually wrote these four episodes concurrently, and you can see how the different threads are running together through these first four stories, and a lot of them are wrapped up now in The Changing Face of Evil, and they introduce some new plot threads that will carry us forward through the final chapter.
Well, and this is what I think is really interesting, Chris, is that they do it this way, that they kind of give us these blocks, and so that they are, I think, in some ways making sure that they wrap up storylines as they're moving forward. And it was almost like the writers themselves were needing to make sure, okay, we're answering this question, we're answering this question, we're getting this answered, you know, and this was an easier way for them to do that. But it also kind of just helps with the storytelling here at the end of this season. We know it's going to be the last season at this point. If you're watching it for the first time, you knew they were coming to an end. And I think it was helping kind of feel like you were getting somewhere, like you were slowly starting to resolve some things as the show was creating towards its ending, because you can't start asking too many questions at this point. You really have to just kind of be asking questions that'll help you resolve the actual, you know, finalness of the show, That, yeah. I don't know if that makes sense, but you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, yeah, I understand. You know, I also wonder if writing it this way, because even though it's four episodes, you're writing it as this block, and so it sort of compresses the events down in terms of remembering, you know, what you've done. And as you talk about making sure that you answer questions and you tie things up and the new things come in, but there's the great scene here in The Changing Face of Evil where they are on the bridge of the Defiant preparing to go to battle, and they ask Miles what's wrong, and he's upset at Julian. He says he lost Travis. You know, he lost the William B. Travis, the Lieutenant Colonel Travis figure from their Alamo model. And now this is the fourth episode, and when you get to What You Leave Behind at the end, that's when Miles finds Travis that he thought Bashir had lost. And I thought that was great that they were able to just pick up that one little moment from this episode all the way at the end, because so much happens in between, and it's just this great callback.
Well, and that was one of those things too, Chris, where this episode takes some time to do some small things like that. If you're watching it for the first time, there's that scene where all of the characters, they're kind of building up the music where they're launching the Defiant, and they kind of look at everybody, and you don't realize that this is going to be the last flight of the Defiant if you haven't seen this before.
Yeah.
But the way that they just do that, it just kind of gives you this sense of being able to kind of stay in the moment for a little bit longer than they would in a normal episode, because they have the time here. And it's so effective, especially as you're rewatching it, because you know what's going to come. And it's really creating kind of this sense of almost foreboding, but you didn't know it the first time you watched it. So I really love that when you're watching it now.
Yeah. And that leads us into the first topic that we'll talk about here, which is contrasting life and war. And one thing that Ira said about the goals of this story was to show domestic life in the midst of the pressures of war. So we have things in here like Cassidy burning Cisco's peppers. And of course, we have Miles and Jules working on their model of the Alamo. And we have these great conversations between Worf and Ezri about Bashir playing with toys. And when we get onto the bridge of the Defiant, like you're talking about right here, they're able to talk about these things that are going on, because as you say, they can spend more time there. And there's that perfect line of just, it's not even the line, it's the way she turns her eyes when they keep talking about Travis and the little figure Travis, and Worf is next to Ezri. He says, he plays with toys. And she rolls her eyes sideways and she says, it's a model. I just love that line.
Well, and I love that too, because she's trying to defend him, because they're having that conversation earlier, like, he plays with toys, you know?
Right.
She's,
but it's
like,
still going on, even on the bridge, when they're about to go to the second battle of Chintaka.
It's awesome. But what I think that this does for the show, in the same way that if you've seen Band of Brothers, there are those moments where they're not fighting, and the conversation revolves around more normal things, more normal life.
Right.
You know, that still goes on. You know, guy, you're still getting letters from home, that kind of stuff. That's happening here. These people still have things that go on that don't have anything to do with the war, you know? And it is funny, too, because you get to that whole little scene where the boys are playing with the Alamo. And Bashir is like, I just like to win once, you know, and he's like, well, be Santa Ana, because he wins every time, you know. But you feel that really Bashir's frustration is that they're also losing the war at this point.
Yeah,
it's going badly. And so his desire to win has nothing to do with the Alamo. He just wants to feel the sense of winning, because he's tired of feeling like they're losing.
Yeah. You know, this is one of the things contrasting life and war here that makes, for me, when I talk to people and we compare the Dominion War arc on DS9 and the Zindi arc on Enterprise, and some people who are very much Enterprise fans, and of course, we're both fans of Enterprise as well. We love Enterprise. But they compare the two, and you know, some people feel that the Zindi arc did the war story better than the Dominion War arc did on DS9, because it was compressed into one season, where on DS9, the Dominion War is stretched out over the course of several seasons. But for me, I think the Dominion War works better because of elements like this, because we get to see on a personal level how life goes on during the war. Even things here like Cassidy trying to cook for Ben and burning up the peppers. And you can imagine that Benjamin would be really upset about that because he can't just run down to the Safeway and buy more peppers like we could. His peppers are gone. And so he's very upset. But at the same time, when you think about what's going on around him, it's a really, really petty little thing. You know, the pepper, they don't really matter when the entire fate of the Alpha Quadrant is hanging in the balance. But it does matter. I mean, those things do matter to us as people, even when there are bigger issues going on around us.
And that's true. And this is, I think, you know, what Enterprise does with the Zindi arc and what Deep Space Nine does is a little bit different anyway. I mean, I feel like Deep Space Nine is doing more of the kind of like a World War II in space, you know, where it's going to be many years. It's going to be a long, protracted war.
Right.
The entire galaxy feels like they're involved in the conflict. And so you do have more time for these because they are really portraying that this war is kind of dragging on, and there are points where there's kind of lulls and they're entrenched in and nobody's really moving back and forth. The lines aren't moving and it's getting frustrating on both sides and all those kind of things. So yeah, this episode really helps kind of encapsulate all of that in these moments of life that happen. And we get some great character moments. I do love that you can tell that Sisko wants to fly off the handle at Cassidy because he is pretty pissed. You can really tell the way that Avery is portraying that he's just not happy. He just doesn't have the energy really to be pissed because he's too tired and too worried about the other stuff, like you said.
You know, Avery portrays that really well in this episode. Even when he walks onto the bridge of the Defiant, he looks so tired.
Yes, like, yes.
It's the war has really taken its toll on him. He's going to do his job. He asks Admiral Ross, when do I leave? He's ready to do his part for Starfleet and lead his crew, but you can tell that he's absolutely exhausted.
Well, and you kind of get that in the characters in general. They're I feel like they're overcompensating in a lot of ways for their tiredness. I think the boys are playing with the Alamo because they just need something to, and Miles even says that, look, I've been working for 14 hours, that Julian says basically the same thing about getting the infirmary ready. These people are beyond tired. And these things in life are things that they're using to try and get some semblance of normalcy back in their brains, because it's just been in and out of meetings and war rooms and battlefields and preparations and all this stuff. They're just exhausted in every way, shape, and form. So I think that this is needed. And it does a good job of not feeling in any way, I think, superfluous, but really just adding to the depth of the characterization and the storyline and getting us to that place that we want to be, because, you know, this is the kind of stuff that makes us miss the show when it's gone, you know, like,
this
is who I miss. I love the war story, but I love who the characters are through the war story. So it's not just the war story that I miss, but it's the characters I miss.
It's all the character moments.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So,
while we're talking about Sisko here, one thing I did want to ask you about that probably won't really fit into the rest of our discussion very much is the relationship between Sisko and Cassidy in this situation. And of course, Quark and Odo are watching them argue, and Quark tells Odo, marriage changes everything. If you're not careful, that could be you and Kira. But the thing that I'm curious what you think about here is that I can see both sides of the situation with Sisko and with Cassidy about him wanting to protect her and keep her out of harm's way and making the arrangement with the Bajoran Freight Commission to give her a month's paid leave so she's not going to be out there. And she's very, very pissed about it. But like, I can understand that she doesn't want to be sheltered. She wants to be her own person and her own woman, because she's a very, very strong female character. And also their marriage is very new, so she's not yet accustomed to this. She's used to being on her own, doing her own thing. And of course, I can see as a husband that I would want to protect my wife as well. I wouldn't want her going out in harm's way, especially when I had the power to arrange things so that she wouldn't have to do that. Do you feel, though, that Cassidy is a little bit overreacting to the situation?
I thought about that a lot, actually, while I was watching the episode, and I can understand why she's upset.
Yeah, I can, too.
It does. It makes a lot of sense. But I do feel like that she overreacts. I think she overreacts because she's trying to set the precedent for the future.
Yeah, I can see that.
But I also didn't like at the end when, right before they leave, where he gives her the flowers and he says, "Am I forgiven?" And she says, "Well, that depends." And I thought that was so petty, honestly.
I think she was kind of joking a little bit, though.
I don't think so. The way that Penny Johnson plays it, I feel like she's being totally serious. I'm really not going to forgive you unless you basically give me what I want. And I get what they're doing, and I understand it. They're trying to help with the female portrayal in the show and make them just as strong as the men and all of that. I get, but that one scene there, I was like, you know, that's not really the way it works in a real marriage. You know, forgiveness is not supposed to be conditional on you doing what I want, or I love you only because you do what I want anyway.
Right.
You know, Ben is in every right in that marriage to say he doesn't want his wife in danger. That's what it means to be a good husband, I think. I mean,
right.
That's part of the vows, you know, to love, honor, protect.
Well, and I think in a marriage that had been around longer, you know, I mean, I've been married for almost 17 years. So like if I did that with my wife, she might want to go off and do her own thing, but she would also be able to see why I'm doing it and understand that and not react the way that Cassidy does here. So I don't know, that part of the story, it just kind of, there are those moments with, I mean, Cassidy's a pretty good character, but there are moments with the portrayal, especially of Cassidy, that don't work for me throughout DS9.
I think what we get to is that we both know why they're doing it. I think everybody in the audience kind of knows why they're doing it. Whether I love the way it completely plays out in the scenes is a different story, but at least I can get it from a creative perspective.
Right, yeah. Well, let's move on to another topic here and talk about the Breen Factor, which I think should be a reality show on Fox.
It does kind of sound like that, doesn't it?
It does.
Can you fit into the refrigeration suit?
Right.
Is their planet really cold or hot, or is Weyoun really just pulling his leg at this point, you know? So
I could see it like, you know, on Amazing Race where they have to eat weird food sometimes. It could be like that, but they have to eat frozen food. It's strange frozen food.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you don't know what it is. It just kind of melts in your mouth, not in your hands. Sounds disgusting.
But no, the Breen Factor is what the Breen bring to this story, because in this episode, they attack Earth, which is something that's rarely attempted by anyone in Star Trek. I mean, the Borg attack Earth. I think the Klingons even say, like, even we never had the nerve to attack Earth. The Breen proved today that they're warriors, Martok says. And then they have this energy weapon that takes out the Defiant in one shot. And so they are the linchpin of hope in the Dominion's war effort at this point. But at the same time, the Breen Factor isn't all positive for the Dominion. It's also a big part of what leads Damar to rebellion.
Well, and this was a really interesting thing, because it was one of those, you felt like it was a Kobayashi Maru. Like, how is the Federation going to overcome this? I mean, if Breen weapons can just take out ships, you know, with one shot, they don't really stand a chance.
Right.
I mean, there aren't that many Breen ships to be able to take on every fleet. But I mean, after a while, they're going to win. It seems like, with this kind of technology.
Well, you could bring squadrons of Jim'Hadar ships to escort one Breen ship and use that weapon.
Exactly.
You know, if you couldn't fit that weapon onto other, you know, I'm assuming, and I think it's actually addressed at some point, isn't it, that this weapon cannot easily be refitted and put on Jem'Hadar ships.
They have a very hard time. It takes them a few episodes to be able to adapt the Breen weapon to the other ships in the Dominion fleet. So it's not something that's easily done. But yeah, this is huge. And then what I didn't understand, at least about the episode, Chris, I think maybe the one flaw, how in the world did the Breen get all the way to Earth? Because they even say that most of the Breen fleet was destroyed.
Yeah.
So did they have some sort of cloaking device that we don't know about that they stole so that they could get to Earth? I mean, you just don't waltz into the Sol system in Star Trek.
I think that they went over into the J.J. Abrams universe temporarily so that they could get from there to Earth just in a matter of hours. And then they used a Borg conduit to come out right inside the orbit of the moon.
Okay. Headcanon. Done.
Headcanon. I just made up right now as you asked me that question.
I love it. So to me, that was the only, that's the only thing I'm like, really? Like, you got to Earth that easy?
I've never really thought about it because, I mean, I have thought about the idea when they say that Starfleet was able to destroy most of the Breen invasion fleet that came in. And I was thinking, wouldn't they be able to destroy all of them, like 100% of them, and probably before they got more than a couple of shots off at San Francisco? I have thought about that before, but the impact of seeing Starfleet headquarters on fire and the Golden Gate Bridge halfway destroyed is so effective for raising the threat level of the story that I've always just kind of dismissed it as, you know, okay, they got there somehow and they did that.
Well, and it's interesting too, because the mission is really honestly more to demoralize the Federation. It's not
just to
so
say
much...
we can hit you at home.
Exactly. So I think that's the main thing. That's the most interesting thing about it is the mission doesn't do it. You know, people die, but it doesn't do so much damage that it really ruins the Federation. It's more of a psychological attack.
Exactly. Which is why the female changeling lets the Defiant crew escape from the Battle of Chintaka as well. She says that those escape pods are full of frightened people who will go back and spread the word.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that this is interesting, though, that by doing this, the Dominion seals its own fate.
Yeah.
Because the Cardassians finally decide and Damar finally makes that switch, and we've been watching it kind of slowly build, and this storyline really pays off when you get to the end, and he's announcing, all Cardassians rise up with me, you know, we're going to liberate our home. It's powerful. It's big. It's huge. And it makes for such an amazing storyline to see this guy go from, you know, Dukat's lackey to the killer of Zial to somebody you're pulling for and you want to see succeed. I mean, goodness, that has been ridiculously fantastic writing, Chris.
It is. I mean, just the whole speech, Damar's speech at the end is really fantastic. I love the speech. And the idea I'm picturing, because you think how vast space is and how much distance there is between all these planets, and you've got Damar broadcasting this to everybody. It's like the back in the 60s, you know, when the president comes on television and takes over all the airwaves. It's like the all the Alpha Quadrant airwaves have been taken over by Damar giving this speech about standing up against the true oppressors of the Alpha Quadrant. And resisting. He says, resist today, resist tomorrow, resist until the last Dominion soldier has been driven from our soil. Resist!
And it's such a great ending that it really leads you, and just you're on the edge of your seat waiting for what's going to happen the next week. Yeah. And it's huge. I mean, there's, you know, because this episode, on top of the Breen factor, we talked about, Chris, the Defiant. And it's fiery end. I mean, you know, we get this huge second battle of Chintaka, which was also just a big deal already in Deep Space Nine. And now retaking this system, the Dominion does, with the help of the Breen, but then destroying our beloved Defiant. This episode is punctuated by some really huge events.
Destroying the Defiant was, I think, a brilliant move in the writing. And as Ira talked about in, I believe it was in the Deep Space Nine Companion, where he's talking about the fact that the Defiant really had at this point become a character on the show. And of course, in Star Trek, when we talk about the original series, the Enterprise is a character. In the Next Generation, the Enterprise is a character. And on DS9, as unlikely as it seemed, if you go back to the search when Sisko shows up with his little ship, the Defiant really did become a character on the show. And you don't want to kill one of your main characters in this battle, so you kill one of your non-humanoid characters, the ship itself, the Defiant. And the fact that the Defiant had been portrayed as this invincible ship for so long on the show made it even more effective, because here's this ship that you see them go into battle. It's like two shots with quantum torpedoes and they split that Breen ship in
half. Yep.
And you think, wow, the Defiant's going to go in and just kick ass. And then they take out a second ship, but that ship gets that little energy weapon off right the last second, and the Defiant's toast.
Yeah. Well, and they talked about that, you know, we had already had Jandzia die. They knew that we weren't going to have any other characters die. Sisko wasn't actually going to die. He's going to become a god.
Mm-hmm.
Nog had gotten hurt. He lost his leg. But, you know, they had needed something to happen, something big to happen, a loss. And yeah, at this point, this brings you to your lowest point. I mean, the Defiant has been destroyed. It can't get worse. I mean, this is one of Starfleet's finest ships. I mean, unfortunately, you never see the Enterprise E in the Sovereign class, you know, kicking some serious ass, because that's what they're made to do. I mean, they're battle cruisers, and yeah, they would have been ripping things apart left and right. But, you know, we never get to see that, unfortunately.
You got to go to Star Trek Online for that matter.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, this is the ship that we have our hopes on and our dreams on. And this is the ship that our crew loves and we love at this point. And it was kind of like losing a family member when you lose the Defiant. And it stings until you get to the end of the episode and at least you realize that the Cardassians are switching sides. You know, because mm-hmm, before that, you're like, well, we're effed. You know, I mean, yeah, like, we're done. I mean, we don't have the Defiant. You know, our pets' heads are falling off. So it's just...
But it does give us something interesting for the Klingons, in that their ships are the ones that are not affected. Or there is the one Klingon ship that's not affected by the weapon. But of course, the Klingons can then make whatever adjustment is needed so that still be able to fight. So our ability to fight the Dominion is temporarily diminished, but it's not completely gone. So they cannot overrun us. And then that's balanced by the fact that the Dominion cannot simply take the Breen weapon and throw it onto all of their ships either.
Right. So they do all that, but at least at this point, we're kind of like, oh, crap. How are you going to, I mean, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And again, I remember watching this and gosh, the Defiant being destroyed, it felt terrible. You know, yeah, I'd grown to really love this ship. And then
it was
shocking, actually. You just didn't think it would happen.
Right.
And then I remember the Star Trek Communicator magazine, one of the pullout pictures was the Defiant being struck by the energy weapon and all of the lightning happening around it on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't hang that one up because it just made me too sad. I was like, I don't want to look at that on my wall. Remind me of that defeat of Chintaka.
Every morning when I wake up, I open my eyes and I'm reminded of our defeat at the Second Battle of Chintaka.
Yeah. Who wants to remember that? Oh, gosh.
Oh, man. So one more thing here on the Breen Factor. I liked something that Damar said to Thot Gore, the leader of the Breen that we always see there with the female changeling and Wayoon and Damar. It's just the two, well, I guess there's another Breen there, but it's the Wayoon has left and the female changeling's not there. And he says to Thot Gore, by the way, in case Wayoon has neglected to mention it, The Dominion once sang Cardassia's praises as well. And then, of course, we get some static. Would you like to do your thought gore voice for us, Matthew? Exactly. That's the response that Damar got. And Damar said, it's really quite simple. They expected the war to be over long ago. It's not. And for that, they blame us. Now, if the war doesn't end soon, they'll shift the blame to you. And as I said, the Breen factor is not all positive for the Dominion. It's what pushed Damar to finally rebel, because you see it when they first bring the Breen, I can't say bring and Breen together very quickly, it's quite a tongue twister. When the Breen first come in, Damar's already not happy about this new alliance that he knew nothing about. And so it really does drive a wedge between the Dominion and Cardassia. And then in this episode, it finally separates them. And then we get the speech at the end, which we talked about already.
Yeah. And it just shows you how capricious the Dominion is.
I mean, yeah.
And you finally get that explicitly said by the female changeling. She's like, I don't give a crap about anyone. I just want to win.
Those were her exact words, Matthew.
Yeah, yes. that's basically, it's like, I don't give a crap. Just win this war. You just see how they use, and it comes from, I mean, you even see this, you know, they've created their people to worship them, the Forda and the Jem'Hadar.
Right.
They don't have no love for these creations. They're just there to serve them, and they treat everybody else like that as well. Because they have this sense of entitlement of, we're changelings, you're not. Suck it. Serve us.
Exactly. Yeah, because she says, I have no idea what pleases the Breen, nor do I care, as long as they fight and win. And that's really all the Dominion cares about. Like, they don't even care about the Jem'Hadar or the Vorta or the Cardassians or the Breen or anyone. Everyone is just a servant to the Great Link, essentially, to carry out their will. Well, let's move on beyond the battle here and talk about some of the relationships. We've talked about Ezri in every part of our final chapter look so far. So far, it's been primarily Ezri and Worf. Now, that's been resolved, and now we can really turn our attention to the real beginning of the Ezri-Bashir relationship. Not that much really happens in this episode that solidifies it, but they're starting the dance. And they're starting to try to talk to each other. And with Worf's help, and Ezri says that thing that all men hate to hear from a woman, that you're a great friend, at least if you had any romantic feelings to start with. And that's what she tells Worf here. But Worf is encouraging her to talk to Bashir if that's what will make you happy, he says. And we do get a scene in the episode where she finally gets up the nerve to go to the infirmary and actually talk to Bashir about what's happening. Now, there's a scene that was not in the episode that is in the script that takes place in Quarks, where Ezri and Bashir do talk a little bit more, although it's still that disconnect where they're not able to actually talk. But Ezri does say that maybe we just need to bring this out in the open, she says. Talk it over like two adults. I mean, here we are, you over there, me over here. When you think about it, it's a perfect opportunity. And Bashir says, Ezri, please just tell me what's going on. But before Ezri can say anything, the computer voice comes on and calls Bashir to the infirmary, and he has to leave so they don't get to talk. And if that scene had been in there, it would make a little more sense later when Miles asks Bashir, did she finally tell you why she's been avoiding you all this time? And he says, no, you know, she tried and la la la. That wasn't in there. But at least here they're starting to try to talk.
Yeah, I think that this is something that's normal in the sense of, you know, when you've been friends with somebody for a while and you realize you have feelings for them, it is a hard thing to kind of move past that and make sure that that's the right thing. And Worf goes, you know, he asks her, is this what you want? She's like, she's just not sure, you know?
Yeah.
She's like, maybe I love him. I don't know. It does kind of sound like a high school conversation, but
I went further back than high school. I actually put in my notes that Bashir and Ezri dance around the issue like middle school kids.
A little bit, but I mean, it is realistic because even as adults, we worry a lot about that very issue. What happens when we move past the point where we're friends? And
it is very true.
You know, so because it's a big deal, and I love seeing Worf and Ezri kind of interacting on the friend level. I think it's really nice. They work really well together on that level. And then watching them watch, you know, Bashir and O'Brien play with the model.
And Worf wants to play too.
He does. Let's make no bones about it. He wants to be down there playing with the model too, helping them try and win. But I think it really does work. And I like that they don't immediately get back and they kind of fall into each other's arms. It takes till the very end of the series. And I think it's smart to let it kind of percolate so that it feels more natural and real when they finally do kind of fall into bed together.
Yeah. So that's here. And I guess what I do like seeing here is what you just said, seeing Worf and Ezri interact on a friend level. I think they had some great conversations in here. And Worf gets to show that he's actually a sensitive guy, not just the warrior that he wants to portray himself as so much of the time.
I think, too, it makes sense because he's talking to Ezri, who is part Jendzia, and she knows him well, and he can be that person because that's who he was to her. That's a part of himself. He's free to be with her. You know, he doesn't have to hide it from her. Because she knows it and she understands it. And, you know, now where they are in their friendship, it's still a safe place for him to be that romantic. Because Worf has always been, especially on Deep Space Nine, we see he has been romantic. He likes that wooing aspect. He likes the commitment. He loves all these things. It's really important to him. And I think, you know, as funny as his parents were on the show when they came on The Next Generation, I think he grew up in a loving home. I think he saw a loving marriage of two people who really cared about each other. And he wanted that. And he found a way to have that with Jendzia. And he's allowed to have that side of himself with Ezri. So it just works in this scene. And I'm glad that they allowed Worf to have the softer side of Worf, you know?
Right. You know, I think the fact that he found that with Jendzia and Dax is why he's able to have it with Ezri now. And it took a lot of working through, which we saw in the first three parts of the final chapter here. But once they worked through that, when he talks to Ezri here, when they're sitting up there in the bar and they're looking down and they're watching Miles and Jules, and he tells her that if that's what will make you happy, it feels very, very sincere. Like he's talking to Dax, maybe more so than Ezri there, in fact, that he really still cares about Dax, and now Dax is a part of Ezri. If it were just Ezri Teagan by herself, I don't know that this connection would have existed.
Right, definitely. I agree with you.
Well, let's move on to another big part of this, unmasking Dukat. And this, every time, the only thing I can hear now when I watch these episodes and I see the two of them together is you saying that you need to have your eyes cleansed out because you don't need to see no old person loving.
Yeah, geriatric romances don't do it for me. So
at least we didn't get any like feeding each other grapes and stuff like that in bathrobes in this episode.
Thank goodness. Everybody was in fully clothed clothing, no bathrobes, you know, hint of bedroomness. Yes, thank God.
The creepy factor was gone here. This was less Angel Tenon and more Dukat, where I feel like Dukat, whether it's hard watching Angel because you completely, well, you know it's Dukat to start with, but even if you don't, you know, the way that Mark Alamo delivers the lines and all, it's still Dukat, and that's why it puzzles me why Kai Winn cannot tell that this is, or even be suspicious. Like, hey, you know, you're a Bajoran farmer. You sound an awful like the evil leader of the Cardassian Union to me.
Yeah, well, you know, we see what we want.
Yeah.
Winn is so close to kind of getting what she wants here. that she's blinded by that desire and that hunger in the same way that I think Dukat is just really driven by this hunger. And Chris, we were talking just on the other side of the orb, and I had mentioned that rewatching this, I felt like, you know, Dukat, part of his megalomania that he has is his desire to be loved by his enemies.
Yeah,
and this was a good really point. To be loved by the Bajoran people. Like, he wants to be beloved by them. And he just can't believe that they don't. I mean, I only killed a few hundred of you at a time every once in a while. You know, I don't understand why you don't love me.
Right.
It's not weird. And so his whole desire with the Paw Wraiths is really to fulfill this sick desire to be loved by the people he's oppressed. And I think it's so interesting to see that play out and how he's willing to use Kai Winn and bed her and all these things, because in some ways I think he's getting perverse pleasure out of corrupting the Kai.
Yeah.
So I think that is just, when you said it got less creepy, to me it got more creepy. As he becomes more and more Dukat, it becomes creepier and creepier. It's almost like a Silence of the Lambs kind of thing to me. Like, just, oh, it just makes your skin crawl when you realize exactly who he is and what he's doing. And yeah, and then of course when Wynn finds out who he is, she's freaked out too, because how do you react to that?
Yeah, Wynn's reaction was really interesting, and I think it tells us a lot about her and what her ambitions have been going all the way back to the Circle trilogy at the beginning of season two. That at first she's freaked out by it, as you say, and it's like her Bajoran upbringing kicked in. And so her first thought about the Paw Wraiths is that I'm doomed. My life is over. I have to find some way to be forgiven for this. But then she realizes what it represents in terms of power for her. And when she kills Solbor, that was shocking to start with. And she stabs him. And I think that even she can't believe that she did it. It's like something took over her body and she stabbed him. But she pulls the knife out. And then she goes over to the book and she says, I have to destroy the book. But she has the knife in her hand. And when the blood drips on the book, and the flames come up and all the words appear, which she's been trying to figure out for so long now how to read this book, it's like it really kicks into her that, oh, I have power now. And now I can get what I really, really want. And the turnaround is so fast that it's like being freaked out that it's Dukat and being concerned that she has fallen into bed with the Paw Wraiths. It all evaporates so quickly that you can really tell that what she really, really wants is power. And I think not even to bring about like a new age for Bajor with the help of the Paw Wraiths, but I see her as being, she's going to be a dictator if she were to come to power.
Well, this happens later, but in our timeline, but it reminds me of the fall of Anakin and the prequels, how he's just able to make that switch because it's going to give him what he wants.
Yeah.
And how that desire, when it drives you and you're willing to do anything for it, you'll do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Anakin's willing to kill younglings, here Wynn is willing to kill her servant who's been with her for so many years. She even mentions that earlier.
It's funny that you jump to Star Wars with this, because the same for me when I watch Wynn here, I always think this is where she turns to the dark side.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Exactly. Welcome to the dark side of the Force. It really is. I think you're right. She makes that turn to the dark side. And
it is.
It reminds me of what Yoda said again.
Fear
leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. And hate leads to suffering. And she's just traveled that whole path here.
Well, you know, it's interesting too. And I know some Star Trek fans aren't going to like us mixing Star Wars and Star Trek together here. But what's interesting is that Star Wars is very much mythology. Star Wars is the hero's journey. It's just straight out of mythology. And what they're creating here with the Bajorans and with this part of the DS9 story, and what's happening with Sisko and Dukat and the prophets and the Paw Wraiths and everything, has just a huge mythological tone to it. And there are these great similarities between what's happening with Kywin and with Dukat and what happens with Anakin and Darth Sidious and that turnaround, which creates Darth Vader as well.
Yeah, I think this is the point in the show where if you weren't aware of it at this point, you're aware of it now that this is mythology. Deep Space Nine is a mythology. It's not an anthology. It's not any of the things that Star Trek has been before. This is really mythos that they are working with here, which is, again, why I think that it stands out above all the other Treks and really sets itself apart and makes it more universal and timeless because of it, the mythos that it's creating that's connecting with all these other mythos that we're so familiar with. You know, Star Wars connects with so many people because it feels timeless, because it's these classic things. Deep Space Nine is doing that because it's playing with a lot of classic motifs that keep recurring in great stories and literature. Deep Space Nine will keep recurring. I'll still keep wanting to go back to it because it's like reading a good classic book. It never goes out of style. You know, last year I reread The Count of Monte Cristo. Freaking fantastic book. It doesn't go out of style because what's being talked about in there by Dumas is so universal to all of us. This idea of revenge, who we are, all that kind of thing. It doesn't get lost. And it transcends its time period. And I think that's what Deep Space Nine does. And that's why so many people, you know, with Netflix and everything and really discovering this and watching it in a serialized format, it just fits where we are now of people really enjoying mythos.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, it's timeless. And I think DS9 right now almost connects with people more today than it did when it first aired. I hear that from people. They're watching it and like you said, really getting into it because of Netflix. But it worked at the time that it aired as well. And it works now. And I can imagine that you could come back to DS9 50 years from now and you could see what's happening around you in the world then and what's happening in DS9 and here in the final chapter even then. It's like of all the Star Trek series, it feels like the one that because of the mythos of it all probably has the longest staying power that would endure and still be the most relevant to you far down the road.
Yeah, and I think what's really interesting, Chris, is how this side, you watch, you know, Dukat move in this direction. You're watching Wynn move in this direction. On the other side, you know, you have Damar and his incredible gambit.
Yeah.
And I think it's the polar opposite of where the character's moving from. You had Dukat move from, like, we kind of like him in a few of the seasons, and then he descends into complete madness. You know, Damar, we really just kind of hate this guy. We hate this guy. We hate this guy. And all of a sudden, he just makes this trajectory upwards. And becomes somebody that we really want to follow and gets to this point of being like a hero. He's going to lead a rebellion. He's the Luke Skywalker. Damar Skywalker of Deep Space Nine, you know. And so, yeah, I think that is it's incredible to get to this point at the end of this episode, and we get that speech that we've talked a little bit about, and it just goes to show how unique Cardassians are, because we've seen lots of different types of Cardassians. We've seen the Garricks, we've seen the Tans, we've seen the Dukats, and now Damar, and they're really a multifaceted race. One of the most multifaceted races I think we see in Star Trek. This is a great place to end this episode because, like you said, I just want to go watch the next one.
That's what I did. I had to stop watching eventually because I ran out of time yesterday, or I would have probably watched all the way through What You Leave Behind because it just keeps you going. And I blur the lines too, like what happens in which episode. I think in this episode today, I may have actually referred to a conversation between Bashir and Miles that takes place in the next episode, possibly.
I think you might have, because I was thinking to myself, I don't remember that conversation.
I think it's in the next episode where Miles comes in and asks, did she ever explain why she's been avoiding you?
Yeah, I think you're right.
But I still think that scene would make more sense mm-hmm. if the scene between Ezri and Bashir and Quarks had been in this episode, because it feels like Miles is referring back to these encounters that they've been having or not having, and the beating around the bush of the conversation that's been going on that we right. didn't necessarily see.
Yep.
But back to Damar here, though, and to Dekot. I mean, you talked about how Dekot became just like, we started to kind of like him, and then he just turned evil. That's something that the writers actually do talk about in writing the show, that they felt that Dekot had become too likable. Like, I'm amazed there's this huge Dekot fan base out there. I know a lot of people who love Dekot. They're almost all women. And I don't know. Is it this thing like where women like bad boys or something? Does Dekot have a Harley that I don't know about?
I think he must. I don't know. You know, he rides around on a Harley. He's just breaking hearts all over the place. It is strange to me. I don't understand it. I never liked Dekot. I never thought he was yeah. a likable character. So I don't get it either.
I mean, I can understand people liking the character of Dekot, because he's a very interesting character up until they make him two-dimensional. He is an interesting character. But liking him as a person, that I don't understand. But the writers did, they noticed that people were really starting to like Dekot and feel for Dekot. And in order to have this final chapter play out the way that they wanted it to, with the dichotomy between Sisko and Dekot in the mythology, they really had to just make him two-dimensional. And he just is out here for evil purposes at this point, to turn the Kai away, to unleash the Paw Wraiths, to destroy Bajor, to destroy Sisko. But like you said, Damar becomes the interesting person at this point, and it's an amazing transformation. And Casey Biggs does such a great job of portraying Damar, well, in general, but especially from here out to the end. And I think that what we see happen in this episode shows that Damar is a true leader of his people in a way that Dekot never, ever was.
Well, and it's great because, like you said, Casey Biggs goes from being that kind of like lousy drunk
yeah.
to being this, you know, way he talks about it in the episode, this focused, determined person. And he becomes the patriot, like the true Cardassian. We talked on Literary Treks with Keith DeCandidigo about Martok a little bit with yeah. his Klingon Art of War, and how he's just kind of the true Klingon. I think Damar is the quintessential Cardassian by the end of the show.
Yeah,
who by the end of the show, you yeah. really can look up to as being what a truly good and honorable Cardassian would look like.
And it's a great story of redemption, right? Because he wasn't that
exactly.
person.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. yeah. All right. Well, I think we've run through all the main points of this episode. It's such a packed episode. What I was impressed with the script for this episode, though, compared to Strange Bedfellows, is how, as they closed out that block of four episodes, things had become more focused. There's only the one scene that is not included that's in the script here, the one that we keep talking about between Bashir and Ezri. And then there is one other a switch from the script where you have Thotgor and Damar and Wayoon, and that's when Damar talks about they're going to shift the blame to you. Then they cut to the scene of Sisko and Cassidy, where Cassidy burns the peppers, right? But actually, the script actually goes into that later scene with Damar and Rusat, the other Cardassian, where they talk about what they're going to do, and they're going to start their they're going to turn against the Dominion. And then you go to the scene with Sisko and Cassidy. So they flip those around. But otherwise, the script is pretty straightforward to what you get in the episode. So they did tighten up and they packed all this stuff in, and they actually got it on screen this time.
Yeah. And then I think it works really well. I actually like that they split that up.
Oh, definitely. It works better by splitting
it. Yeah, I think it works much better.
Yeah. Flipping those scenes around. So we go to Sisko Cassidy, then we come back. Because otherwise, it's kind of disjointed for Damar to go straight from talking to Thought Gore to talking to Rusite.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, it would. I don't think it works really otherwise, because it you'd feel too disjointed.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one thing we didn't talk about, Matthew, I can't believe we forgot about this. We didn't talk at all about what Jake is doing in this episode.
Who?
That's right. This is another. Sirach Lofton does not appear in this episode.
Dang it. Bummer. Oh, well. Well, maybe next time.
Maybe next time. All right. Any final thoughts on the changing face of evil, Matthew?
You know, Chris, I don't know if there isn't anything that we haven't, you know, just kind of touched on in the episode. I think are broken records when it comes to this series. We love it. It's fantastic. Yeah. But again, this episode sets itself apart by creating some smaller, more intimate moments, some slower moments, taking its time. I think that's important in storytelling, and I think that this is just really a masterclass on how to craft the end of a series with so much mythology, and how to do it well and to wrap it up well. And they are paying off characters and situations and things in ways that we never thought possible, especially with somebody like Dumar. And I think that makes this just a fantastic episode all in all. I mean, you know, it's a perfect 10 out of 10 as an episode for me. I enjoy watching this episode too, as you said, because it does kind of pay off that first 4 episode block and really put some things to rest and then give me some new things to think about. And I love that. It just kept me wanting more.
Yeah, I'm with you. I give it 10 out of 10 Breen energy weapons.
Nice.
You know, this episode will just take you out in one shot. All right. Well, that
is... It's like
is
a golden gun in James Bond.
All right. Well, that is the changing face of evil. Next time we come around to the final chapter here, 1 month from now, we'll be talking about the 5th part, When It Rains. But until then, we will have plenty of stuff for you to listen to in the world of Star Trek. In fact, if you've enjoyed this show, we have lots of other stuff on the network this week for you to listen to. And here's a quick look.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
DC Fontana.
The genes and everybody saw what she could do, and they allowed her to transcend the role of secretary, much as Peggy in Mad Men.
Earl Grey.
Saucer separation.
And usually it's said very dramatically, the star drive section only? What?
Like they left half the ship? Where is it?
The other half will come on Tuesday.
Could it be in a pocket dimension? I don't even know.
You left space dock without a saucer?
The Ready Room.
Yoda.
Jerry Taylor wrote the book on Janeway. Literally, she wrote the book on Janeway, and she reinforced that ideal and that history and even made Mosaic canon because she could. The Orb.
Imagining an Abramsverse DS9.
I feel like that would be the arc of the first season, would be, what are the wormhole aliens? Are they aliens? Are they gods?
You know, do they have smoke powers? Monsters?
Are they smoke monsters? Is that them around the corner there?
Why is there a polar bear on the station?
To the journey!
Top 5 Voyager action sequences.
Of course, I want you to do your Kate Mulgrew impression of her last words in the episode.
Time's up.
That has to be your best one yet.
Oh, thank you!
Warp 5.
Romulans on Enterprise.
I think even in Kirshara, the Romulans might be thinking, like, we need to infiltrate the Vulcans. We need to bring them back to our side so we can nip this in the bud and make sure that this growing alliance doesn't happen.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Nemetric Part 1, Trek.
This is actually the one episode where I enjoy Neelix when he's being annoying. But then also, he gets a little something-something with the Klingon ladies.
Melodic Treks.
Because it is literally those two ships playing hide and seek in the nebula, but all the way through the music is there. It's keeping you rooted to what's going on, and it's just a major and integral part of what is going on the screen.
Literary Treks.
Bones chooses about being either a healer or a Starfleet officer, and he chooses in this situation to be a Starfleet officer. And it kind of...
not easily.
No. Easily oh, no, decision. Not at all.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. We have a lot of shows for you every day this week. You know, we just relaunched Hyper Channel, which used to be our video news show. We've now relaunched it. And I'm doing that every day now. I'm bringing you two or three stories from the world of Star Trek every day on Hyper Channel. And with that and the Captain's Log and all of our regular shows, we've got two or three, maybe even four new pieces of content for you every day on the network. And a great way to get those is to subscribe to the Trek FM Complete Master Feed, which includes every episode of every show and some other special audio content as well. And you can get that in iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and on Swell. And Swell is like the Pandora of podcasts, by the way, if you want to check out that app for iPhone, and they're in beta on Android right now as well. And apart from those, you can find the rest of our feeds, all of the dedicated show feeds, in iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Swell, BlackBerry, Spreaker, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune. We're pretty much everywhere that you get your podcasts. And you can also go to our website and stream, or grab the RSS feed and drop that into your favorite podcatcher as well. Well, if you'd like to share your thoughts on Deep Space Nine's final chapter, on the changing face of evil, or anything about Deep Space Nine, you can contact us in a number of ways. You can go to our website at trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that will come to both Matthew and me by email. You can also find us on Twitter under username TrekFM, on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. We have a community on Google Plus now. Look that up on G+. And we have traditional forums on our website at trek.fm/forums. And we would love to hear from you. We'd love to talk to you about Star Trek. So hit us up in one of those places and let us know what's on your mind. Now, Matthew, when you're not trying to figure out how to protect yourself from the Breen energy weapon, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me doing Literary Treks with you, where we talk about books and comics and Star Trek. And you can also find me on my personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Now, Chris, when you're not at home playing with your huge, gigantic Alamo model trying to figure out just how to defeat Santa Anna and his amazing army, where can we find you?
Yeah, I like to tell Travis not to wander off. I don't want him to get lost anymore.
He's really bad at that, you know?
Just, man, poor Bashir. He got the blame for losing Travis, and Travis was still there the whole time. Goodness. Give him a break, Miles. Now, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username, as well as on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And then elsewhere on the network, besides doing Literary Treks with you, Matthew, you can find me on Warp 5, which is a lot like this show, but all about Enterprise. You can find me on Continuing Mission, which is about fan films and fan series, and I interview the people who make those on that show. I also have Matterstream, which is an interview show about the world inspired by Star Trek. And there is The Ready Room, which I host every single week with other hosts from all around the network and special guests. And we talk about Star Trek news and all five live-action Star Trek series on there. And as I mentioned earlier, also catch Hyper Channel and get your daily dose of Star Trek news. Find out what's happening in the world of Trek. Also, before we let you go, we'd like to tell you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com, the best source for audiobooks that you'll find online. As a Trek FM listener, we have a special offer for you. You can get a free audiobook of your choice just for trying Audible. And the way you get that is to go to audibletrial.com/TrekFM and sign up. Choose any book you want absolutely free. They have new releases, bestsellers. They have lots of Star Trek books as well. Pretty much anything you want in any genre, you're going to find over there. I've been getting my audiobooks from Audible for 14 years now, which is hard to believe and a little bit scary if you think about it, that it's been that long listening to audiobooks. I love listening to them on my commute, you know, when I'm out exercising, wherever I am, and it's a great way for you to read all the books that you've always wanted to read, but if you're like me, never thought you'd have the time for. So help us out, help us keep the orb coming to you every week by trying Audible. Go to audibletrial.com/TrekFM. Get that free audiobook. If you decide not to stick with Audible, you get to keep that at the end of the trial, so there's nothing to lose. but you'll be helping us keep all our DS9 talk coming to you every week. So we really thank Audible for their support of the show and the network, and we thank you for supporting Audible.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.